Good morning. The Old Testament reading this morning is from Song of Songs, Song of Songs 5, verses 2 to 8, and you can find it on page 550 in the Pew Bibles. So Song of Songs, chapter 5, verses 2 to 8. I slept, but my heart was awake. Listen, my beloved is knocking. Open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my flawless one. My head is drenched with dew, my hair with the dampness of the night. I have taken off my robe. Must I put it on again? I have washed my feet. Must I soil them again? My beloved thrust his hand through the latch opening. My heart began to pound for him. I arose to open for my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with flowing myrrh on the handles of the bolt. I opened for my beloved, but my beloved had left. He was gone. My heart sank at his departure. I looked for him, but did not find him. I called him, but he did not answer. The watchmen found me, and as they made their rounds in the city, they beat me, they bruised me, they took away my cloak, those watchmen of the walls. Daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you, if you find my beloved, what will you tell him? Tell him I am faint with love. And then the New Testament reading is from John, chapter 8, verses 2 to 11, and that can be found on page 868 of the Bibles in the pews. So John 8, 2 to 11. At dawn he appeared again in the temple courts, where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now what do you say?" They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let any one of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." Again he stooped down and wrote on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away, one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left, with the woman still standing there. Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go now and leave your life of sin." This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks, Natalie. Josef, you're off lightly this morning. No male part. So we are in the second week of a four-week series on the Song of Songs, the wisdom of God for love and sex. A whole book of the Bible devoted to romantic love and its sexual expression. And last week we discovered that despite the church's attempts to, in the past, to de-sex the book and adopt or even enforce an allegorical approach to the Song of Songs, the book is, as it reads, an erotic poem in the praise of sexual love. In fact, not just any poem. In his book, How to Read a Poem and Fall in Love with Poetry, Edward Hirsch, the American poet and critic, describes the Song of Songs in these words. He says, "It's the greatest love poem ever written, rejoicing in extravagant analogies and proclaiming the imaginative powers of language in celebrating erotic love." And I hope you've taken a moment out from the busyness of the week to read and enjoy this poem. Perhaps at the end of the day, you know, the kids are in bed or the grandchildren returned, the lights down low, glass of wine in your hand. That would be a very appropriate analogy given how often that turns up in the book. And if you have read it, then I'm sure you would have picked up the dominant theme of the book that we focused in on last week, the first message of the Song of Songs, is that it's a celebration of the joy of sex. and maybe that message struck a chord with you. And then again, perhaps it didn't. And before we go any further, let me say this. For some of you, this could be a difficult sermon to hear. If you carry wounds from past sexual trauma or experiences that bring pain or shame, then please know you're not forgotten. The God who sees and knows you also grieves with you, and the church is meant to be a place of healing, not of judgment. Because perhaps in your lives or in the lives of family or close friends, there are sexual relationships that are anything but celebratory and joyful. Rather, they're characterized by hurt and despair. Betrayed people who have a partner sleeping with somebody else. Guilty people who are sleeping with someone that they shouldn't. Lonely people who long for intimacy. Impotent people who crave sexual performance. Abused or confused people who are suffering from the effects of dysfunctional sexual relationships. And frustrated or desperate people whose sexual or relational problems are overwhelming them. That is so often the reality of our lives or the lives of those we know. And the Song of Songs recognizes that reality. Because alongside the dominant theme of vibrant celebration, there's another theme in the book. And this is the second message that I'm going to unpack and reflect on today. The second message of the Song of Songs is a warning of the power of sex. And this is weaved throughout the Song of Songs, particularly in the chorus that's sung three times in the book. We see it for the first time in chapter 2, verse 7. The woman is warning her listeners. Daughters of Jerusalem, she says, I charge you by the gazelles and by the does of the field, do not arouse or waken love until it so desires. The daughters of Jerusalem are other women who are looking in on the relationship between the woman and the man in the poem. So they're surrogates for the readers, for us. And the woman is saying, do not force or hurry love. And it's repeated again in chapter 3 and chapter 8. Do not arouse or waken love until it so desires. Why does the writer keep on telling us this? And the answer is at the end of the book, at the climax to the overall poem, in the controlling poem of the book. And I'll return to this and unpack it in detail next week. But this is the one place where the poet gives a commentary on the type of love that he or she is speaking about. Place me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm, for love is as strong as death. Its jealousy unyielding as the grave. It burns like blazing fire, like a mighty flame. Many waters cannot quench love. Rivers cannot sweep it away. If one were to give all the wealth of one house for love, it would be utterly scorned. The poet is saying, awaken love at the proper time, and it's a delight. But mistreat it, and it has the power to destroy you. After looking at the joy of sex last week, this week we're going to look at the dark side of sex. To do that, we're going to focus on this poem in chapter 5. So I do have it open in front of you. But before we do that, I want to make a few preparatory points that arise from comments made to me after last week's sermon and will also help us to understand this particular passage properly. My first comment is that there's a difference between the erotic and the pornographic, although both are concerned with sex. Some Christians recoil from anything that has a sexual content. Sometimes they do this because they have such a high view of sex that they think it shouldn't be mentioned publicly, or especially in media, literature, art, movies, etc. It's just too sacred. And sometimes they recoil because they have a wrong view of sex, are completely embarrassed by it, somehow as if the physical is less than God's best. Both reactions might result in thinking that any literary depiction of sex or sexuality must be pornographic. The Song of Songs says, not so. The erotic and the pornographic are both concerned with sex, but there is a difference. Eroticism approaches sex obliquely and with restraint, whereas pornography approaches it directly and with no restraint. Eroticism approaches sex with depth and is designed to explore the many dimensions of human sexuality. Pornography is shallow and designed simply for immediate sexual gratification. Eroticism is also concerned with people as subjects in relationships, whereas pornography is concerned with people as objects of sexual stimulation. And I'm going to illustrate this difference by considering two films in the career of the famous actress Natasha Kinski. She came to a global prominence when she played the lead role in Tess, Roman Polanski's film adaptation of Thomas Hardy's novel Tess of the D'Urbervilles. And there's a scene in which Tess, as the innocent, naive country girl, she's fed a strawberry by the sophisticated and suave Alec as he's trying to seduce her. And as you can see, Tess is fully clothed, even with a hat on, but it's an extremely erotic and sexually charged scene. But it is oblique and restrained. There's a certain depth to it in the context of her relationship within the film. So this is erotic. But compare this scene with many of the nude scenes in her breakthrough movie, Stay As You Are, in which she played a young student having an affair with an older man. These are direct, unrestrained, were considered gratuitous and caused controversy at the time because she was just 18 years old. And in an interview later in life, she regretted this film, and she said she felt exploited by the industry. So that is pornographic. Now, there is nothing pornographic in the Bible, but the Song of Songs, in chapter 5 in particular, is intensely erotic. So how does this erotic work in chapter 5? It works through the use of a double entendre. This is my second introductory comment. This particular poem in chapter 5, it gets its force from operating at two levels of meaning using double entendre. How does it do it? Well, I'm going to use two illustrations that neither by themselves explain how it works, but taken together they will. Now, many of you may despise double entendre as a low form of humour, not really for polite Christian people. But I have evidence that some of you do appreciate it. I asked someone this week how it had been their week, and he said, good. After your sermon last week, my wife and I did some gardening together. And I said in my innocence, that's great. Karen and I enjoy gardening. And then he grinned. And I remembered that they live in an apartment and they haven't got a garden. It's a play on words. Something that seems innocent on the surface carries a deeper, usually suggestive meaning. It's a kind of double entendre we find in the Song of Songs. Similar in that it is sexual, but it's also dissimilar in that it is trivial and designed for laughs. Thank you for laughing. This example also serves to illustrate that it requires a context to understand it, doesn't it? Those of you here not here last Sunday wouldn't understand possibly the double entendre because you didn't know the context. Very good reason to come to church every week, then you get the jokes. So that was my first example. And in the second example, I'm going to use a parallel with African gospel tradition. Many of the spiritual songs were sung in a slave context and they had dual meanings. For instance, Swing Low, Sweet Chariot.
Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me up. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home.
Swing low, sweet chariot. It's at the basic level, it's an allusion to Elijah being taken up in a chariot into heaven in 2 Kings 2, verse 11. And there certainly was a deep yearning in the slave communities to go to heaven and be with Jesus. But it also functioned as a desire for political liberation. The sweet chariot referred to was the name of the Underground Railroad, a network used by slaves to escape from the south of America and go to the north. So simultaneously, they were singing intentionally of two things at once. An example of double entendre. Not sexual, but serious. Not trivial or comic. And the double entendre in chapter 5 is both sexualized, like my first example, and serious, like my second. Its effect is not to make us laugh, quite the reverse. It's designed to make us feel the power of sexual desire. Now, it's poetry, remember? So it's not written to give us a step-by-step account of the dark side of sex, but as poetry, it's designed to evoke a mood, a sense of foreboding and distress. It's an evocative example of the downside of sexual desire. So, introductory remarks over. Let's have a close look at the chapter. Chapter 5, it describes two encounters, one between the lovers in verses 2 to 6, and one between the woman and the city watchman. Let's take them one at a time. And in the first encounter, the male lover comes knocking at the woman's bedroom door at night. And he says, "Open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my flawless one. My head is drenched with dew, my hair with the dampness of the night." But the woman, well, she's ambivalent because she's changed and ready for bed. "I've taken off my robe. Must I put it on again? I've washed my feet. Must I soil them again?" But he persists, rattling at the door in verse 4, and she changes her mind in verse 6 and opens the door. But by then he's gone, he's had enough, and she is frustrated. "My heart sank at his departure. I looked for him but did not find him. I called him but he did not answer." So the night doesn't end in romantic reunion. Now, there is already sexual electricity in this encounter, if it's read in a purely literal, straightforward way. But the incident can also be read in an altogether more erotic way, and this is where the erotic double entendre comes in. Because the metaphor of the door is well attested as having sexual connotations in ancient Near East. We can see this in the Song of Songs itself, so later on in the poem, in chapter 8, verse 9, when the brothers of the woman in the poem are giving an assessment of her. They say, "If she is a wall, we will build towers of silver on her. If she is a door, we will enclose her with panels of cedar." And a wall means that she's a virgin, and a door means that she's sexually available, even promiscuous. So that's the context, and we need to understand context to understand the double entendre. So read against that background, that the door and associated furniture being sexual metaphors, then this chapter becomes sexualized and deeply erotic. I read verses 4 and 6. "My beloved thrust his hand through the latch opening. My heart began to pound for him. I rose to open for my beloved. My hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with flowing myrrh on the handles of the bolt. I opened for my beloved, but my beloved had left. He was gone. My heart sank at his departure. I looked for him, but did not find him. I called him, but he did not answer." Now, hopefully I don't need to explain this to you at the physical sexual level. That would be to destroy the metaphorical medium that the poet has chosen, that God has chosen. But I hope you see that this poetic incident evokes intense sexual frustration, whichever level we read it at. As the Song of Songs says, "Love is as strong as death. It's jealousy unyielding as the grave. It burns like blazing fire, like a mighty flame." Let's have a look at the second incident. So the woman is continuing. "She's gone outside and the watchman found me. As they made their rounds in the city, they beat me, they bruised me, they took away my cloak, those watchmen of the walls." The woman, in her desperation, goes out looking for her lover. Now, of course, this is a poem, not an actual incident, but you can't help thinking, what are you doing? Stay indoors, it's not safe. And you would be right, because she's attacked by the city watchmen, the very people whose job it is to protect the city and its inhabitants. They beat her, they bruise her, they take away her cloak. We're not exactly sure of the meaning of the article of clothing. Maybe it points to a sexual attack, but the incident speaks of brutality in a sexual context. And it ends with the woman pleading with her friends, "Daughter of Jerusalem, I charge you, if you find my beloved, What will you tell him? Tell him I am faint with love. The woman's desire for her lover, her unrequited love, drives her from the safety and private intimacies of her bedroom into the cold, harsh, public, urban setting where she's physically, perhaps sexually abused. And now she pines for her lover. She's sick with love, desperate with desire, and pleading to be united with him once again. This night that promised a romantic reunion turns instead into a scene of violence and violation, reinforcing how desire, when thwarted or misdirected, can leave us deeply wounded. Love is as strong as death. Its jealousy as unyielding as the grave. It burns like mighty fire, like a blazing flame. Last week, we saw that sex is a good gift of God to be celebrated with joy. This week, we are warned that love and sexual desire are powerful. And in a fallen world twisted by sinful rebellion against God, the power of sexual love becomes a mixed blessing. And the result is this. Either we overestimate the power of sex, or we underestimate the power of sex. Firstly, we overestimate it. Some of us are single and not having sex, whether from moral choice or lack of opportunity or physical, biological, or health reasons. And there is an understandable sense of frustration, particularly when we live in a culture that assumes that everyone is sleeping with someone. And we can begin to imagine that all the deep desires of our hearts will be satisfied if only we could have sex with someone. Sex becomes the great idol that we look to for satisfaction. But the same could be said for you if you're in a relationship, married or otherwise, in which you are struggling. You begin to think, if only I could sleep with someone else, then the deep desires of my heart will be satisfied. And many people slip into extramarital affairs because they think that sex will answer their problems. I've got to an age where a few of my friends are divorced, and often the catalyst is extramarital affairs. There have been problems within the marriage, not actually sexual, but relational, and one of the spouses has gone elsewhere to find their desire met, their desire to be heard and understood and known and loved. And they meet someone, perhaps similarly needy, and they connect. And it begins with sex because the physical intimacy of sex is masquerading as the emotional, even spiritual intimacy that they're really craving. And sex is not designed to meet those deep desires. It happens because we overestimate the power of sex. We imagine it will meet those deepest desires, and yet it doesn't. But equally, many of us underestimate the power of sex. Sex has become a form of recreation, a way of seeking thrills and pleasure, a way of getting that orgasmic adrenaline rush. Or maybe we see sex as a way to build relationships. So fairly on in a relationship, when we find ourselves romantically attracted to someone, we start to sleep with them to build the relationship, but the relationship doesn't work out, so we start another one and then another one. And very soon we find ourselves in just a serial romantic relationship and a serial sexual relationships as well. And soon we feel relationally numb, but still see sex as a way of starting relationships and kick-starting depth, when if anything, it makes a relationship more shallow. A very long time ago in my life, pre-Christianity, pre-marriage, I was about 19, I was at a party and started chatting to this girl. We were getting on well, we were obviously attracted to each other. And then out of the blue, she says, "Will you still speak to me if we sleep together?" Now, I know I can't tell you the answer to that question without condemning myself, so I'm not going to tell you what I said. But I'm thinking, well, what motivated that question? Probably previous sexual experiences in which sex has been used by young men and by her, to be fair, for physical gratification, not even to kickstart a relationship. Relationship has ended before it even begun. So nights of sweet intimacy had resulted in mornings of cold silence. That is what it looks like to underestimate the power of sex. We pretend it's just recreation, but because we're worshipping at the idol of recreational sex, it has enslaved us and won't let us go. And we find that far from being more human, we become less human, less able to relate to others. And we can also underestimate sex in using it in marriages, as well as outside marriages. We underestimate it as the power to bond, to provide cement, adhesive, to hold together a lifelong one-flesh relationship. Sex is for marriage. Not just in the sense of only for marriage, exclusive to man and woman who are married, but also in the sense of for the benefit of marriage. Sex is good for marriages. And so when one couple no longer personally desires sex, then the couple's sex life might end. This could be to the frustration of the other. And more importantly, it might also weaken the marriage unless the couple acknowledge the situation, recognize this is an opportunity of self-sacrifice of one or the other, and look for ways to strengthen their reunion in other ways. The Song of Songs says to us all, "Do not arouse or waken love until it so desires. Love is as strong as death. It's jealousy as unyielding as the grave. It burns like blazing fire, like a mighty flame." If we overestimate the power of sex and look for it to do something it was never intended to do, then we will be burnt. And some of us might feel trapped in our sexual history, as if we're stuck in patterns of behavior or shame, believing our past defines our future. And similarly, if we underestimate sex and do not look for it to do what it is intended for, we will also be burnt. And some of us, or those we know, have been burnt to various degrees, fingers burnt, scorched, suffering 3-degree burns because of sexual experiences. Professional counseling, therapy has an important role to play here. But I would encourage you and those you know to seek this help and early, not later. But that can only go so far. The good news of Jesus Christ is that he is full of love and mercy and forgiveness. This is the message from our New Testament reading. He doesn't turn his back on wounded people, like the woman caught in adultery, even if those wounds are self-inflicted. Like the woman, we too are not condemned to live in the same narrative. Our past doesn't have to define our future. Through him, the cycle can be broken. Jesus can rewrite our story. He's the great doctor of our souls. His death can bring healing to the most burnt sinners. So if you have been burnt through either over or underestimating the power of sex, let me encourage you to come to Christ. Because he's not only the healer of burnt souls, but Christ is the only one who will meet the deepest desires of your heart. So what does it look like to come to Christ, particularly if you're tempted to idolize sex or marriage? It means first recognizing that your identity is not in your relationship status or your sexual history, but it's in Christ. It means surrounding yourself with people who will point you to him and not the next romantic escape. It means learning patience, pursuing purity, trusting that your deepest desires won't be satisfied by sex or marriage, but by communion with Christ. And it also means accepting that for some, this will remain a struggle, a lifelong struggle. And that's okay. Jesus walks with you in the struggle. Unlike the lover who vanishes in the night, Jesus never leaves. He doesn't knock and disappear. He stands at the door and knocks, and when we open it, he comes in to stay. So to those of us who are single and not having sex, to those of us who are using sex as recreation, to those of us who are married and struggling in our sex lives and thinking that sex might be greener on the other side with somebody else, to all of us, in fact, Jesus says, come to me, worship me, not sex, and experience deep satisfaction and contentment that only I can bring. Yes, in the context of frustration and sinfulness, in the midst of a fallen world, but also in the deep knowledge that you are loved and you can love and you will be loved for all eternity. Let's pray together. Loving God, we thank you for the gift of love and sex. Guard us from its dangers and help us to honour you with our desires. Where there are wounds, bring healing. Where there is confusion, bring clarity. Lead us always to Christ, our faithful and healing Saviour. Amen.